You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blickman. Good afternoon.
Hey, Caster. I'm just seeing on the wall here that I missed the Auckland Record Fair on the weekend. Damn it.
It is.
Nobody told me. Gutted.
Yeah. It's a bit of a travesty, but we can always pick up records in other places and appreciate them on air. We play them all the time, which is nice. This is the station to be listening to.
Indeed.
If you want to hear some. And also, if you want to hear some science, such as we were gushing about this morning, we're starting off with how to cook an egg perfectly. What kind of eggs are we cooking?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I thought I knew about boiling eggs, but, you know, I obviously don't even begin to know anything about boiling eggs. And so this is the question to everybody out there is, how do you like your eggs, basically? Mm. When you have a boiled egg, do you like it runny on the inside? Do you like it hard boiled? Do you like it in between?
Mm.
And what's perfect?
Is there a perfect answer?
Well, apparently there is.
Mm.
Apparently there is. Now, obviously everybody is different, but I think there's probably some consensus as to, you know, we don't like them too hard, we don't like them too soft. We like the Goldilocks.
There's a median option.
Just right.
Yeah. There's certainly, I think, you would find a universally acceptable.
You would imagine so. And the people who like them absolutely solid are probably in the outliers.
Yeah.
Probably. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I have no great preference, to tell you the truth. I'll eat them any way they come. Mm. But there's a group in Italy who thought that they needed to answer this question: how do you cook the perfect boiled egg? And so they've just published the results of this in a journal called Communications Engineering. And now, eggs present us with a unique problem, because there's two bits to eggs. There's your white and there's your yolk, or the albumen, the white, if you want to call it that. And now, if you're going to cook those, what you're going to find is that they cook at different temperatures.
Which is a real shame.
And there's your problem, okay? So the albumen, if you're going to cook the albumen, if you're going to cook the white of the egg, that needs about 85 degrees Celsius to cook. And if you're going to cook the yolk, that needs about 65 degrees Celsius. So you can imagine now we have a problem, because just chucking them into a pot of boiling water, obviously we're going to, you know, overdo one and underdo the other, or we're going to overdo them both or underdo, you know. So that does make things difficult. And as I said, everybody likes them, you know, their own particular way. So you've got your soft-boiled, you've got your hard-boiled, and you've got, which I didn't know, the sous-vide.
Oh, what's a sous-vide?
The sous-vide is a little bit less than soft-boiled.
Right.
Apparently. And the way that you get a sous-vide egg is, get this, you cook it at 60 to 70 degrees for 1 hour.
Oh.
Yeah.
So a bit of commitment to your egg there. Yeah.
Indeed. You've got to really want that, don't you? Now, with the sous vide, what you're going to get is the undercooked white. Okay. Your yolk might be okay, but the white's going to be a little bit undercooked. So these folk in Italy thought, right, how do we get the perfect egg? And so they did what anybody would do. They went to a computer, of course they did. And they started simulating the cooking process.
Can we accurately simulate the cooking process?
Well, seemingly they can.
Wow.
Seemingly they can. And so, you know, they put all of their variables in there and everything and, you know, hit the button and said, right, show me the best way. And basically the best way that the computer came up with was alternating the egg between 100 degrees Celsius for 2 minutes and then 30 degrees Celsius for 2 minutes. And then 100 degrees Celsius for 2 minutes, and then 30 degrees, on and on for 32 minutes.
I don't know if I care about this.
It does seem like a time-consuming process, but it must be worth it, right? What kind of outcome do we get?
You know, that's what they're saying. So the way that this works, what they could do was they could measure the temperature inside the egg as well as it was cooking, okay? And so what this process gives you, you get a nice soft yolk, okay, so it's not a solid yolk, and you get a white that's like a soft boiled.
Ooh,
okay, so you're sort of getting the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And the reason is, and as they showed, measuring the temperature inside the egg, the yolk stayed at a constant 67 degrees once everything got up to temperature.
Ah.
Whereas the white alternated between 35 degrees and 100 degrees because obviously it's insulating the yolk from the outside heat, okay? And it surprising me, I mean, you know, what everyone goes on about a three-minute egg, don't you? You know, that's sort of meant to be a good boiled egg. Throw it in there for 3 minutes. All your egg timers and everything, they were 3 minutes when I was a lad. And so it amazes me that you can put it in 100 degrees for 2 minutes and then 30 degrees for 2 minutes and then 100 degrees for 2 minutes, blah, 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 and so on and so on. And it doesn't go absolutely rock solid.
Yeah, well, because I've heard of putting eggs in cold water after they're cooked.
Yes, indeed.
That sounds like a similar, at least, principle, right?
I don't know. I mean, that's not contributing anything to the cooking.
Right.
Per se, though. You've just cooked them and then wham, you whack them in cold water. So all that that's doing is cooling things down inside. Right. It's not actually contributing to the cooking. So this, you know, this whole thing is, to me, quite remarkable. So, you know, you've got an egg that's going to spend basically 16 minutes in 100 degrees.
Yep. And it's completely fine.
And the other 16 minutes is going to be at...
Yeah.
And look, I'm almost tempted to give this a crack.
A good one. Give it a crack.
Poet didn't know it. And just see how we go with that. I think it would be a very interesting thing. So anybody out there in Radio Land who wants to try this and, you know, report back at...
32 minutes on your...
Yeah.
On hand.
So remember, 100 degrees, 30 degrees, 100 degrees, 30 degrees.
Yeah, and probably do multiple eggs at the same time.
That's a good scientific thing to do because we're talking reproducibility there, yes.
And also probably like a time thing, right? You'd be thinking 32 minutes for one egg. Probably not worth it. 32 minutes for four eggs.
Indeed.
Now we're thinking of some value there.
And now what they didn't mention, or perhaps I didn't read the paper clearly enough, but they didn't also mention the egg size, whether that, and you would imagine that would surely
That was my immediate thought.
Your sixes and your sevens and your eights, you know. Yeah.
Would we have some sort of ratio, maybe, egg size to cook?
And your brown eggs and your white eggs, maybe they're leaving this for a subsequent publication.
We'll be looking at some future research.
The way that scientists do work occasionally.
Yeah. And then I guess perfectly following on, fear in the brain. I don't have a good segue for
that
this.
That does not segue nicely at all, but
I have no fear of eggs, but perhaps some do. Oh, actually, this was another question that I meant to ask about the eggs. Oh. Do we know, like, in terms of cooking eggs, obviously there's some risk of eating a raw egg. Of which part do we have to cook? Is it the yolk? Is it the white? Is it both? Do we know?
Well, you don't have to cook either necessarily. It's only if your eggs are infected with nasties, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, people have raw eggs.
Yeah.
I can't say I ever have, and the thought of that is just quite revolting. But, you know.
That's some sort of fear, which segues perfectly.
Now, there we go. There we go. Worked it well.
And how does it work?
How does it work? Now, there's a damn good question.
Mm.
Well, what is fear anyway to begin with, and where does it come from? And I would call it, and I quite like this, an evolutionary evil.
Evil? Really?
Yeah. Well, think about it. You know, wouldn't it be great if we didn't fear anything?
Well, it seems a little bit inconvenient.
No.
Oh, I'm honestly a big fan of fear in terms of I would prefer that people weren't running at, let's say, lions in our evolutionary history, right? I think it's pretty good that we're sticking away from predators.
Well, I mean, fear, it has to be evolutionary, you know. It has to be instinctive because, you know, babies are basically born with it, aren't they?
Yes, that's true.
You know, so...
Perpetually scared, even.
And that's the thing, that... you know, like babies are, you know, you make a loud noise and then they're going to start crying because they're scared. There's a fright. There's something that they don't know what that is. And yet, you know, when they grow up and be kids and stuff like that, then you take them to a fireworks display and there's loud noises, you know, right, left and centre. They're fine with it.
Mm.
So they've learned somewhere along the line that loud noises
are
not necessarily a threat.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So workers at University College London have been studying fear, and of course everything comes back to the brain, doesn't it? This is all going on. So what we would like to know is whereabouts in the brain is fear manifested isn't quite the right word, or processed or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
where's it happening?
Where in the brain is this all happening? Because if we could figure that out, then... wow, we could look at, you know, serious treatments for anxiety and, you know, PTSD and those sorts of things.
Which are the less good kinds of fear, I think.
Yes, that's fear taken to its unnatural extremes, unfortunately. And So, you know, as I said, the brain obviously does learn over time that some things that we think are threatening are not necessarily threatening, so we don't have to be scared of them. So these workers at University College London, they started off looking at mice. And what they did, as these things often do. And so what they did, they used this overhead shadow on mice, okay? So they generate this overhead shadow and the mice think, oh, hell, that's a bird coming to get me. Or, you know, something like that. And so as they started off doing these tests, they would introduce this overhead shadow onto the mice and the mice would run, you know, scurrying, think, oh, hell, you know, this isn't good. But eventually, once they found that there was no obvious threat, that nothing bad was going to happen to them as a result of this shadow, they eventually calmed down. And they sort of, you know, figured out that this was nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah.
And they'd gone from a situation where they did fear it to a situation where they didn't fear it, okay? And so this learned ability, you know, whereabouts in the brain is that happening? So therefore, these researchers then studied the brains of these mice, as you do.
Yeah.
And they managed to figure out where this learned behavior was occurring, or this learning of this behavior was occurring. Yeah. And it's in a thing called the ventrolateral geniculate nucleus, or VLGN for
sounds
easier.
Sounds like a pretty fearful place.
And so basically they have managed to narrow this down to this particular portion of the brain. They say, right, you know, that's where in the brain fear is controlled.
Yeah.
And the avoidance of fear or the learning to not fear fear, I guess, is happening in that particular part of the brain.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is fantastic news. And so now they're going to get into sort of human trials and see if what they have learned about mice translates to humans. And, you know, as I said before, this could have massive implications in terms of, you know, your phobias and your anxieties and stuff like that, which sadly plague some people, and it's a horrible damn thing. So, you know, anything we can do to get rid of that.
I'm curious about these mice. Right, they're lab mice, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Since they were. So how do they know to be scared of the bird shadow?
Again, that's the instinctive thing. Yeah. It is. It's instinct. You're born with it, you know. And that in itself is quite incredible.
Yeah, because, I mean, surely I'd assume a wild mouse would be more fearful, maybe less susceptible to relearning.
You would have thought so, but obviously, you know, if it's instinctive, then it's it probably has to be somehow genetic. It's got to be built in, hardwired there somehow, and everything comes back to genetics. So, you'd think anyway. That's my thought on it. So, fascinating stuff. You know, anything to do with the brain is fascinating stuff. It just is. So.
Yeah. And then lastly, here something to do with conversation. We've got the gender split of talking.
Yep.
Or conversation participation.
Yep.
There's a lot of stereotypes around this issue, which I imagine is why
it was... Well, there's basically one stereotype.
Which I imagine is why it was investigated. I'm curious to know the answer. I have a suspicion, but I'd like to... Yeah, what is the split?
So, well, back in 2007, there was a study in the USA that looked at this particular question, you know, which gender talks more, men or women?
Hmm.
And so this was a relatively small study, so there were only about 500 participants, and they were all sort of college-age students and stuff. So it was not a very wide cross-section of society, shall we say.
Yeah.
Okay. And basically what they found in that particular study was that basically men and women were found to speak pretty much the same number of words a day.
Which makes sense to me, I think.
And the way that they did this was they used a recorder, but it only came on at random times. So people in that case were unaware of the time that they were being recorded. So they weren't just sort of talking for the recorder.
That's a good one.
Sort of thing, okay? So they had to think of that. And now this study had sort of been criticised and everything. So one of the original authors has now gone back 20-odd years later, nearly 20-odd years later, and now they've done a much bigger sample size. So now I've got 630,000.
Oh, that's a substantial increase.
So it's essentially one of these sort of big studies. So there's 22 separate studies, and so it's a meta-analysis of these and over four countries, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And, right, so the guts of it was that, yes, they did find a definite gender difference and that over the ages 25 to 64 in that age range, women spoke 21,485 words a day and men spoke 18,570 words a day, okay? Now, in any of the other age ranges, there was no difference found. It was only in this particular age range that there was a difference.
I have a few guesses as to why there might be that difference.
Fire away.
Okay, so my first thought is that men typically, given familial gender roles, probably going to work more frequently than women.
Yep.
And women raising children more. So there's the commute time, you're probably not even talking, right? So that's factoring out maybe 2 hours of the day for some people.
Yeah.
Whereas for mothers, that's probably 2 hours where you're talking even more.
Exactly. Yeah. And that seems to be the major idea anyway that the authors came up with. That yes, it's a lot of you know, women talking to their kids.
Yes.
And that could account for the difference. What they also found interestingly, so in 2007 they found that the average for everyone was around about 16,000 words a day.
Mm.
Now that's dropped to 13,000.
Wow.
So people
that's
are
a substantial drop as well.
Mm. So people are talking less. Okay. Which, and again, what's the idea behind that? It's good old social media and tablets and, you know, all of those sorts of things. Devices.
Maybe we've started to listen more. Maybe that's the
Yeah, but if people are talking less and you've got less to listen to.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Mm. So So that's sort of the guts of this particular study. So it has been proven, this is a thing, for 25 to 64-year-olds.
Specific age group,
For that particular age group.
And I feel like the context there is very important.
Of course.
But very interesting.
Yeah.
It's a lot of science for us to talk about. I'll just bring up this one text we've received about the eggs. This person has a method, a tried and true method.
Here we go.
5 minutes in boiling water. Lightly crack wider end of egg as soon as they come out of the pot. This creates a cooked white and a lovely gooey yolk.
I think you should get in touch with these Italians.
Yeah, they haven't even considered cracking the egg.
No, they haven't.
At the very end.
No,
there's so many variables. Maybe this is also part of a future study.
Publish now. Yeah, absolutely.
We're doing science past, present and future here on Dear Science, looking into all these aspects. Thank you, Alan, for coming in this week. Thank you, Mota, as always, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.